Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. I want to thank you all for tuning in to join us for today's virtual brown bag entitled Nonprofit Healthcare Transactions Beyond the Hospitals. This program is being sponsored by the health law and the tax exempt sections. And I'm going to be the moderator for today's conversation. I'm Emily Kretschmer. I'm a partner at Crocetis and Bluestein in their health and human services practice. I do a lot of work with healthcare providers, both in the hospital space and outside. So I'm really excited to have some of my colleagues here on the panel with me today to have a really interesting and robust conversation. I know we were hoping that this program would have had the feel of the brown bag lunches sort of prior to COVID and that we'd be able to see everyone's faces, but unfortunately the BBA hasn't been able to set it up that way. But as we have our conversation today, it'll be a moderated conversation. We really hope to encourage audience participation and dialogue. So you can use the Q&A box to submit any questions. I will, during the discussion, try to keep my eye on it and, you know, address any kind of topics or questions coming from the audience. So, you know, as I mentioned, we have a great group of attorneys here today that are really in the trenches on this topic and have a lot of information and experience to share. So I'm going to turn it over to each of them to just give them a brief introduction about themselves and their practice area and what brings them to today's panel. So just starting on my screen, I'll start with Cheryl. You're on the left.
Hi, my name is Cheryl Howard. I'm a partner at Crocetis and Bluestein in the transactional group. And so my role in connection with these transactions is to help manage both kind of the governance approvals, certain AG approvals, and then kind of any real estate or other financial due diligence that needs to be addressed. And I would often work with one of my colleagues in the Health and Human Service group, such as Emily, for the regulatory piece.
Mike.
Thanks, Emily. My name is Mike McGrath. I am a partner at Ropes & Gray. I sit in our healthcare practice and also kind of have a hat in our higher education industry group, as well as our public finance group. And I, you know, similar to Cheryl, kind of deal almost exclusively on nonprofit transactions, largely involving kind of what I just listed, healthcare entities, academic entities, either healthcare related or not, as well as kind of a variety of other research type organizations that are nonprofit in nature, kind of have that spectrum of both experience on the transactional side, the tax exempt bond side, and then also the regulatory approval side for all of those. So happy to be here and happy to talk with everybody.
Emily.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Emily Gabralt. I'm the Deputy Chief of the Public Charities Division at the Attorney General's Office. My background before coming to the Charities Division was with our healthcare group, where I did a lot of healthcare policy work, some of the cost containment work of the office. But I did, prior to becoming deputy chief of the division, focus a lot of my attention here in the Charities Division on healthcare-related nonprofit issues that came before the office, and in no small part, I included a lot of the transactions that folks have heard about and have worked on. So happy to be here to talk with you all today.
Great. Well, I think we'll just get right into it and start the conversation. And, you know, I think it'll come as no surprise that, you know, we all saw the headlines this morning in the paper. United Health Group's arm of Optum has made a filing with the Health Policy Commission to acquire Steward's physician practice. And, you know, I think as we're all kind of chatting online before the program began, this isn't the first time that Optum has reached into Massachusetts. And, you know, over the last few years, there have been a few transactions where they've acquired nonprofit physician group. So I think that'll be part of our discussion today. And the steward conversation is really a conversation for another day and to itself. But I think it really nicely frames a lot of the issues that healthcare providers outside of the hospital space are dealing with, maybe in a different magnitude. But I think, you know, a lot of the staffing issues, the financial challenges with reimbursement are, we're going to find, are sort of key strategic reasons that nonprofit healthcare providers are thinking about transactions. So I thought it'd be interesting to sort of level set the conversation today to just, you know, get a feel from each presenter as to, you know, the trends and the transactional area that you're seeing and what types of providers in the healthcare space you're seeing it in. So maybe, Cheryl, do you want to start us off?
Sure. So I'm certainly seeing a lot of consolidations. I've worked with several nonprofit boards who, you know, ran a rest home or a nursing home for, you know, sometimes almost a century, but are finding it more and more difficult financially to sustain operations in the current environment and kind of wanting to look for a way to keep the nursing home or the rest home operating, but not seeing a way to do that as a standalone entity. And so looking for partners or consolidations or kind of other ways of addressing that. And in kind of in for religious orders, in those cases, you know, those entities that, you know, their population is aging. And so they're, even if they have very profitable, you know, operation, they are kind of realizing that they're not going to be around to operate it that much longer. And they want to look for a partner who will be a good steward of the facility. Emily, I think you're on mute.
All right. Yes, thank you. I was going to say that, you know, just sort of to build off that point that you're seeing in the religious area. I mean, I think we're also seeing a lot of transition in leadership of agencies, right? In these nonprofit agencies, they've been there for many, many years. And sometimes they've done some robust succession planning. Other times, you know, they're just kind of winging it. So have you seen a lot of that be some of the reasons why folks are looking to enter into transactions?
I mean, I've certainly seen some cases where the board is really aged and the board is tired and, you know, wants to find a plan. And they may have struggled to recruit new board members. With respect to some of the convents or some of the religious organizations, you know, the kind of the convent itself, their population is aging. They don't have those younger members in the convent to manage operations. And so they're looking for a plan. And often because their sisters are at these facilities, you know, their focus is really on who's going to take good care of the residents, you know, after we're gone, you know, make sure that this remains to a good home for the members of the order going forward.
Mike, what are you seeing in your practice?
Yeah, so similar to Cheryl, seeing, you know, a lot of thought of consolidation. I think the big issue on people's mind is with consolidation in the industry, either vertically or horizontally happening around them, that, you know, depending on what industry you're in, you know, or what specific function it is, it is very hard to go out. And I think the Optum example that you laid out at the beginning, Emily, is a really good one where I represent a lot of health plans, especially nonprofit health plans. You know, there is this thought towards a vertical integration model, right? Where, you know, that's certainly what we see United and Optum doing with their transactions involving, you know, Atrius, Reliant, and now the Steward transaction. It's a push to, you know, try to control really the primary care physicians, of course, and then, you know, in doing so, you know, try to drive down costs overall. And then when you're kind of either a smaller provider organization or smaller kind of ancillary long-term care facility, or even a smaller health plan. Now it's, you know, it's being seen as it's very difficult to compete with the big guys, you know, which brings up lots of antitrust issues as well, that are coming into play. But that's kind of where you're seeing what boards are thinking about, is that, you know, the bottom line is really being driven. And the other thing we're seeing, you know, certainly on the hospital side, but also on the provider organization side, is there is a lot of pressure post-COVID. You kind of had all of this push of provider relief funds that came in, and kind of there was a lot of thought in 2020 that all of a sudden we'd see, you know, folks going, you know, towards bankruptcy because just all the patients had dried up, right? And that doom and gloom didn't happen at the time. But I think with the Steward example, and, you know, with some other clients we're talking about, where we're talking to, you know, they're seeing that financial pressure now, right? With those private provider relief funds kind of disappearing. And, you know, we're still not back to kind of the pre-COVID status quo of, you know, patient volume. And, you know, particularly for facilities, people are being pushed further and further out to, you know, less high acuity care, if at all possible, which is, you know, really impacting the bottom line.
So in that, have you seen, Mike, you know, people looking at less acuity and trying to manage cost and reimbursement? You know, have you seen any partnerships in the telehealth space? Or, you know, I know we have a lot of standalones entering in that. I don't know if it's really crept yet into the nonprofit transactional space yet.
Certainly there are a lot of clients who are looking hard at, you know, telehealth models. You know, I haven't seen any really big transactions personally in my practice. That doesn't mean that they're not happening out there. You know, as far as trying to get further into telehealth, I have seen it for some large hospital systems, which I know isn't quite the topic that, you know, we're looking at today. But I do think coming up with innovative models, whether it be through some sort of joint venture structure, I mean, folks are certainly looking at that. The two reasons I see joint venture structures, you know, realistically, and, you know, kind of getting in maybe a little more to the weeds of different transactional structures, is one, trying to do something new, or at least, you know, trying to take a component of that is maybe slightly ancillary to the organization's practice and monetize it, or, you know, make it better with another partner that's out there. So that's kind of door number one. And then door number two is larger transactions that may have some, you know, regulatory or antitrust scrutiny on them, and trying to structure it in a way, you know, that avoids ultimately having to go through a full change of control transaction, which could, you know, which could end up being blocked, or, you know, have significant conditions put on it. Instead, do something, you know, that is more akin to a JV type partnership. That's definitely, you know, something I'm seeing a lot of in our practice.
Good to know. So, Emily, right? I think Cheryl and Mike and I are talking to the provider organizations, but, you know, depending on how the transaction is structured, the Attorney General's office gets involved in the nonprofit tax exempt is there, the practice. So can you speak to a little bit about, you know, what's you've seen as trends, you know, in the last few years at the AGOs?
Sure. I think much of it mirrors what Cheryl and Mike already talked about. We're seeing a lot of organizations come to us and say, we just can't stand on our own any longer. It's not viable as a business model for us. And so we're taking X, Y, and Z step. You know, a lot of times I think when we see full transaction reviews come across our desk, it's when an organization is saying to us, we haven't found another nonprofit partner. Really, we need to sell our business. I think when we're seeing nonprofit partnerships come up, they tend to be coming to us as an FYI about member substitutions, folks who are kind of joining efforts, but not necessarily conducting a full-blown sale of assets to the other nonprofit. I will say that we appreciate the heads up on those types of transactions. You know, it's something that we still look closely at and want to take a minute to review, even if it might not technically fall under the statute that requires notice to our office. I think a lot of the space we've seen outside of hospitals right now has been in like the long-term care, nursing home, some of the behavioral health, and even some of the dental practices that were historically set up as nonprofits. We've seen some shift there as well. I think it's also probably notable that we've had over the past few years a not insignificant number of cross-border transactions. And so some extra kind of considerations when we're looking at what's happening with those types of transactions as well.
So we're going to get to cross-border transactions a little bit later in our conversation, but just to kind of stick with this initial question, you know, as organizations are starting to think about different types of transactions, I know, Mike, you brought up joint ventures, but there's really a whole spectrum of considerations. And, you know, Mike and Cheryl, I thought maybe you could, you know, discuss sort of maybe Cheryl, the beginning of the spectrum and Mike, the end of different, you know, options that these boards can consider when they're starting to think strategically.
Certainly. I mean, I think it to some extent depends on the goal of the board and, you know, what their particular needs are. I work with many clients who want a nonprofit successor. And so, you know, specifically go out and look for that. You know, and obviously that does help expedite review at the AG's office if you're going to, you know, have that type of transaction. You know, sometimes there's internal things that can alter how the deal is structured. As an example, you know, I worked with an entity that was acquiring an under entity. And initially we thought it would be kind of a member substitution structure. But the underlying entity was an operating foundation, and the tax status of that entity made it more difficult to structure the deal that way. So sometimes you kind of go into it thinking it's going to look one direction, and then as you understand more about the deal and the parties involved, that can shift. You know, I assume like the liabilities at issue might be a concern if the acquiring entity was concerned about, you know, potential liabilities of the other entity. They might structure it in a way that they had a little more separation from that entity. They might start out as a manager, for instance, and move to a more kind of a closer relationship later. You know, sometimes we've, you know, and again, it will sometimes depend, the kind of next step will depend on what the board's goals are. You know, some boards really do want to stay involved in some capacity. And so they look to become an advisory board. They look to have some continuing relationship. Other boards, if they are truly done, may care less about that. You know, sometimes they want to make sure that, you know, the name is preserved, the employees are kind of kept in place. So, you know, so those are all different concerns, and different boards give those, you know, different weight.
And Mike, what have you sort of seen on the other end of the spectrum as you're moving towards?
Yeah, so I think Cheryl, you know, good on the, you've got the contractual affiliation, management affiliation, management agreement type model. And then moving forward, you know, a joint venture, which I kind of have an asterisk next to. It's typically not in an acquisition type model that you go for a joint venture, although sometimes if there is like a component that some company wants to go in. And then, you know, from there, I think, you know, Cheryl hit on a member substitution. That's really kind of the next model. And there, I think that's the one that provides the most potential flexibility, because you really, from a governance perspective, can structure that. I mean, you know, I have a lot of qualms with Chapter 180 and Massachusetts general law. It's a little outdated, so to speak. And I know the BBA is well aware of that, as are a number of stakeholders. But it one thing it does do is provide for a pretty expansive amount of flexibility in establishing rights vis-a-vis a member over a board. So, you know, to Cheryl's point, you can go from everything of having a very strong board at the quote, the acquired entity, the subsidiary level, that still has real teeth and rights in what it's doing and in managing the day to day, you know, to some models now where, you know, essentially, you know, I think the shorthand is a non-fiduciary board, which I think is I personally don't agree that concept really exists, that there's such thing as a Chapter 180 that has a non-fiduciary, you know, board. But what that I think is shorthand for is you've delegated up to the member a significant amount of responsibilities and rights, which is permitted under, you know, under Chapter 180 in our nonprofit law. And the member really is managing kind of the day-to-day function in, you know, either affirmatively or with approval rights over what the board is doing. So that's kind of the member substitution substitution model, and it allows for an increase in autonomy. The downside is, you know, integration could be hurt as a result of it, and you might not get the same efficiencies that you would from one of the other structures, which moving on is kind of an asset sale transaction or statutory merger. You know, technically there's a consolidation as well. I don't know. Has anyone ever done an actual like true legal consolidation of you get A and B and C comes out of it? I'd be interested. I've never seen that done, but it is, you know, technically out there.
An option. I've never done one in this sector. Okay. And I think I've only done one over my career. So they're not that, even though it's an option that's out there, I don't think you see it very much.
Yeah. So,
and I've seen, you know, two organizations come together and form a new parent entity. Sure. Right. So it's not at the provider level, but there's been a consolidation above.
Right. And that is just all of the health, again, trying to stay away from hospitals themselves, but the health systems in the state, you know, and frankly, Point 32 Health, MGB, BILH, you know, Tufts Medicine, all that model kind of is all of those structures. So kind of going back to the asset sale model, I see that most in two scenarios. One, liability protection issue. So if you are trying to transfer, maybe not all assets and all liabilities across the board, but you're trying to leave some liabilities behind, maybe leave a bolus of cash behind to deal with those liabilities, but then otherwise move operating assets over, even if it's a nonprofit transaction. I've seen that. And then obviously the other example, which I know we're going to get to in a second, is, you know, for-profit acquisitions of nonprofits. That is really the model that is available for that. As well as cross-border transactions, given, again, some of the fun nuance in Chapter 180.
And I think some of the other reasons that healthcare organizations tend to stick with the member substitution model is for reimbursement purposes, right? Because their Medicare and Medicaid and other payer agreements are tied to the tax ID associated with the provider organization. So, you know, if you were to do a merger and asset sale and change that information, you know, it becomes a cash flow consideration and, you know, something that can sometimes be challenging to manage as well. So, Emily, I mean, I think that leads us nicely into, you know, the Attorney General's office. And, you know, I think you see everything, but you see a lot of nonprofit for-profit transactions. And, you know, I think one of the burning questions that we were talking about in prep for today was, you know, what can you do to get to yes with the AG? Like, how can folks on today's webinar, you know, try to get their clients prepared before the outreach to the Attorney General? And what are some of the things you're thinking about?
I'll give my two standard disclaimers, the first being that I speak on behalf of myself and not the office. And the second being that we are not the final arbiter over any transaction. So our yes is just, we don't have any more questions. But in getting to that stage with our notices, I think that the kind of key pieces of that are early engagement, fulsome disclosure. So as much information as you can give us as soon as possible, and then open dialogue. So we like to make ourselves as available as we can. We think it's helpful, especially if your clients are considering any sort of major transition or change or transaction, to be in touch with us as soon as you have a sense of what that shape is kind of turning out to be, so that we can help maybe issue spot if there's anything that we're concerned about. And then if you do need to provide us a formal notice, we have good guidance on our website about the, you know, the five P's, the types of information we want to see in there, the purchaser, the proceeds, the price, all that type of information. I think what we're almost always going back and asking more for, especially when we're thinking about, you know, I'm going to call them conversions, even though we don't have conversions like it by statute. When we're thinking about these nonprofit to for-profit transactions, is more information about what your client has done to pursue other nonprofit options. So what did they look at first before they found themselves in a position where they needed or decided that the only option they had was this for-profit sale? And that's usually where we're asking for more information. I think folks are pretty good about getting us information about fair market value and the appraisals, their conflict policies and how they've managed that. But we are going to be asking a lot of questions about why this is the appropriate option and what other options have been explored first. And then we're going to want to know what happens with the shell of the nonprofit when you're done. What kind of assets are going to be left over? What kind of restrictions exist with those assets? What are your intentions for that corporation? Is it going to carry forward and do something new, become a grant maker? We could talk about what process would need to be in place for that to happen, what kind of petitions you may need to prepare to ask to use the assets differently. Or if the, you know, kind of next result is going to be dissolution of the charity, then we can kind of talk in advance about what that looks like as well. But I think the key piece of information is to expect some back and forth with us. So come to us early and not on the eve of your deadline, and to provide as much information as you can upfront so that we can review it before we have a chance to.
That's helpful. So taking what Emily just said, Cheryl, do you have any tips for how you would, you know, get a nonprofit healthcare provider's board, you know, start to think about the transaction and what they need to do to evaluate it, so that they can, you know, come with a lot of information out of the gate once they're ready to make it public and have that conversation with the Attorney General's office?
I mean, boards come to us at all different stages of evaluating these options. You know, sometimes they've hired a consultant, and the consultant has already started to kind of pull together potential partners in the transaction. And so they're bringing it to us usually at the kind of term sheet stage, or sometimes even beyond the term sheet stage. But sometimes, you know, you have an organization that's just looking for options and where to start. And again, you know, I'd want to understand, you know, what their concerns are. You know, what types of, you know, what type of ongoing role they want to have with the entity. And then they can think about, you know, for instance, if they want to look for a nonprofit partner, how to potentially make those connections and find a nonprofit partner. I'm using kind of partner very generically here, just to mean kind of the organization that would take some role in connection with the facility. Or whether, you know, there really isn't that partner available. I mean, you know, sometimes they'll look very close to home. For a few of the organizations I've worked with, they have an existing manager. And so they might look to that manager as kind of the next partner for the organization, especially if that's a nonprofit entity. If they're really coming up short, then they might look at actively marketing the site. And then, you know, they would need the help of, you know, experienced, you know, brokers and consultants to try to get the best value that they can for the facility. And I would say that, just to kind of build on what Emily had said, you know, often, you know, one of the issues that we have is that the clients want to keep these transactions very confidential. And so they're often very reluctant to kind of have us reach out early. But, you know, we don't want to surprise the AG's office. And to some extent, the AG's office often asks for things that at least the target organization might even want, in terms of, you know, making sure the assets are, you know, preserved and used for the purposes that the organization, you know, has. And so, you know, as an example, for a recent transaction, which involved it was a nonprofit member substitution, and the new member was an out-of-state nonprofit. And so we knew the AG's office might have some questions and concerns about that. So I called, and I believe I actually spoke with Emily kind of on an anonymous basis, and I didn't initially identify the client, but said, you know, just, you know, I know you can't give us specifics, but what would your office look for in connection with this type of transaction? What type of concerns would you have? And then we use that to kind of inform our affiliation agreement, and, you know, kind of built in some of those things so that when that was signed and I went back to Emily with more specifics, I could actually show her that we had kind of taken to heart the AG's concern. It gave our board some leverage to get those concerns, which, you know, for many of them, they wanted to see those terms in the affiliation agreement. So it gave them some leverage to get that. And it also helped us kind of facilitate things with the AG's office, because we could show them that we had addressed their concerns in that agreement before we needed an amendment or something along those lines. So that's a model that we've often used, where you want to involve the AG's office, but the client may be reluctant to share specific information.
So, Mike, I mean, a number of these organizations, they all vary in size and resources and board involvement, right? But, you know, at the end of the day, if you're packaging something up for the AGO, you know, you have to address all their points. So what kind of tips do you have for organizations who might have a more limited budget or a less involved board and, you know, making sure they tick all the boxes to be able to, you know, present a well-vetted transaction and that makes sense?
So Cheryl alluded to this a little bit, we get involved at very different points in various transactions. And sometimes that is because there is a hesitancy to involve lawyers who are a cost, you know, early, you know, until they absolutely have to. Right. And oftentimes it's to draft whatever the definitive documentation is after they've kind of negotiated and agreed to terms. And I do think that is, you know, penny wise, pound foolish for a lot of organizations, even ones who we recognize are, you know, could be cash trapped. I mean, they're probably doing a transaction because they're in some level of financial distress. So, you know, my advice would be like all of us, you know, in private practice on this call, at least are very experienced with working, you know, with organizations that have those limitations and not, you know, putting our, you know, as soon as we get in, you know, pedal to the metal and, you know, just billing hours and hours, but just an initial gut check to talk about what are some of the issues that Cheryl, you know, kind of really laid out and, you know, that Emily also, you know, flagged as considerations for the AG, considerations for other regulatory bodies that would be out there. I mean, there are just so many kind of traps for the unwary in a lot of these transactions that you could really get far, far down a road and it'd be very costly to make a U-turn, but a U-turn might nonetheless be necessary because you've gone, you know, in a manner that, you know, just isn't feasible. I had an organization who spent, I think, a couple years. So this was an organization that was a Massachusetts-based charity and they just didn't want to be in Massachusetts anymore. Their operations weren't really based in Massachusetts. And they, you know, they weren't in any financial exigency or anything like that. They just wanted to be a nonprofit in a different state. And so before they brought us in, they went well down the road of kind of coming up with ways to basically extricate themselves from Massachusetts, which, as we know, there's no nonprofit, you know, conversion statute in Massachusetts. There's no ability to, you know, domesticate in another jurisdiction as a Massachusetts Chapter 180 nonprofit corporation. So they had settled on just dissolving themselves and transferring the assets to a, you know, corporation they were setting up in another jurisdiction. And kind of when we got involved and got the AG's office involved, I mean, that analysis turns on impossibility and impracticability of, you know, and I don't think they had ever really thought about that. So, you know, luckily in that circumstance, we're able to talk them through, you know, ways in which you could still be in Massachusetts nonprofit and continue to do the things that they wanted and the flexibility that they needed. So it was a happy result at the end of the day for the client, but just things like that, I think it is getting to the point of getting in, you know, legal counsel who's kind of experienced in these transactions earlier rather than later, even if it's just an issue spot, even if it's just a couple hours of their time, I think that can add real value. And then kind of moving forward from there, it's just prepping the board, you know, for, and it depends on whether you're the acquirer or the target entity, using those terms very loosely here. I mean, that might not fit into all transactions, but the considerations are going to be very different in both of those. And I think Cheryl talked at length to the targets, to quote target or acquired entities considerations. And I do think oftentimes the regulatory approval process can help those entities and get more of what they want out of it, because the AG, but also, you know, DPH, you know, HPC is kind of looking for, you know, some of those same things, insurance transactions, division of insurance. So I'll stop there, but.
And I think those are all important. I mean, I think also really educating the organizations about the timeline, right? Because if they're bringing in the lawyers later in the game, there are a number of regulatory approvals, both with the AG, but as Mike noted, in the healthcare space with the Department of Public Health or the HPC or other regulatory agencies that really have a number of requirements and other scrutiny that, you know, can slow something down as well. So, you know, just understanding how to best maintain your organization and, you know, meet your fiduciary duties until you can close on a transaction, right, is also another consideration. So I think that led us nicely to really talking about these cross-border transactions, right? If you have to, you know, I think, Emily, I think first it'd be interesting to hear from you why you're seeing different organizations, particularly in the healthcare space, but maybe there's some generalizations too about why organizations are looking outside of Massachusetts. I know healthcare has become more regional, and for economies of scale, there's, value to having strength in numbers, but that also has some other considerations that come along with that.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you what we're being told, right? Because we're being told once people have already made these decisions. But I think a lot of it has to do with the consolidation in the industry in general, folks needing to be supported by a larger organization to continue operating. And then, add on top of that, the regional nature of healthcare, the direction we're moving in there. But even in the long-term care space, we're hearing more and more about consolidation in that space. It's some interesting questions about who's doing that consolidating and how that's happening, right? But that's happening on a national level as well. And it's not sparing the charitable nonprofits that we have that are running those types of businesses.
So if you have a nonprofit that comes to you and is looking to do a transaction with someone outside of Massachusetts, what are some of the guideposts that you find helpful for nonprofits to think about?
So I think the first thing we always talk to folks about, and I think it comes as a surprise for people who maybe don't practice in Massachusetts, is our merger statutes and the inability for a charitable nonprofit to merge and having the resulting entity be a non-Massachusetts-based corporate entity. And so that, I think, is a first kind of line of conversation that we end up having with folks. This is what Chapter 180 says. If you're going to effectuate a merger, the resulting entity needs to be a Mass 180. And then it's like a lot of conversations about, oh, geez, that's not what our clients really want to have happen. So what other structures have we seen to maybe get to the same endpoint that don't involve doing a merger? And that's in some parts, when it's been nonprofit to nonprofit, why we've seen these member substitutions kind of step in. And then we're talking to folks about the way that we see the Massachusetts law applying to the use of assets that were raised here for purposes that were intended to be conducted in Massachusetts, and what happens to those assets when you're part of some sort of entity that cross borders. And so we call it kind of colloquially soldiers at the border language about use of those assets in Massachusetts, what law applies to the use of those assets, and what happens if the broader entity ever winds down its operations. And I think that's, in some respects, what I think Cheryl was alluding to earlier, when we have those conversations about cross-border transactions, we're looking to see those types of issues addressed in whatever agreements are being drafted between the parties.
That is helpful to know. So then, sort of on the flip side, where you have these more, the conversion of the nonprofit to for-profit, right? I mean, what are the considerations around keeping the assets and making sure that they remain charitable and the AG's role in that type of transaction?
Sure. So, once I think we get past this idea of impossibility and practicability, right, they have no other options but to conduct this type of conversion to sell their assets to a for-profit. We're looking to see what the proposal is for the use of those assets that would be retained. So the cash that's left over, what the proposal is from the original Massachusetts entity for use of those moving forward. When we look at the bigger transactions recently, Reliant, Atrius, that was the proposals around the foundations that were set up and funded. Atrius, I think, is well known, has the Health Equity Foundation now that's doing some really great work in Eastern Massachusetts. But we had conversations with them about, well, what's your catchment area? Who are you serving with that foundation? Who was Atrius serving prior to this transaction, and who should you continue serving moving forward? How is the mission of this foundation as near as possible to the type of work that Atrius was trying to do when it was an operating provider group? And so it's trying to get ahead of some of the questions that will need to come forward when you make the request to the court to use those assets in a different way.
So I think that's really good to know, but not all organizations are big and can set up their own foundations. Mm-hmm. Cheryl, what has been your experience with organizations that, they're smaller, they're healthcare providers, and, they're going to do an asset sale or some sort of transaction and that, they're no longer going to be in operation? What are some of the other options out there?
For smaller organizations, I can only think of one where they kind of decided to keep some funds and become a grant-making organization. I mean, that can impact the tax status of the entity. You know, if you have a board that's already kind of tired, are they going to be prepared to engage in this type of review and activity going forward? You know, if they become a foundation, the tax filings are very different. And so, you know, whether they are prepared to navigate those waters, I think is a big question. You know, for many of them, I think they do choose to dissolve, and then they look for a successor for the, you know, who can either, you know, sometimes they'll have a fund set up with another foundation, a community foundation that's, you know, that kind of covers their region. And, you know, they, you know, like our advice, obviously that is a process that's going to require, if they're a public charity, AG, and then court approval. And, you know, we talk about kind of how to structure the foundation so that the grants that it's making and the organizations that it's funding are closely tied to the charitable purposes of the original organization. And often you can work out an agreement with that party. And again, you know, you'd want to involve the AG's office to make sure that they agreed with that assessment, that it was a consistent use. But often that's a better option because many of these organizations, they're not prepared to become grant-making foundations. It's just a very different world from the world they were operating in. And so that can be a good solution.
Well, and I think another area where I think we've seen some folks, you know, put a little bit thought into it is they want to continue to hold on potentially to real estate and be landlords. And, you know, how is that problematic for nonprofits?
You know, I'm trying to think of a kind of a client that's held on to the real estate. I mean, you know, again, you'd have to think about, you know, your charitable purposes and kind of how that would impact your tax status. You know, being a landlord is, I assume that in this case, they would be the landlord of the facility. And so they would have some kind of lease agreement. And, you know, being a landlord is a different job and, you know, not without its pitfalls. So, you know, it's, you know, depending on why you wanted to exit the transaction, I think you'd want to think about why you're holding onto the real estate. And whether it's, you know, and kind of how you are continuing to fulfill your charitable purposes by holding onto the real estate.
No, I think that makes sense. So when you're evaluating these types of transactions, you know, a number of financial considerations need to come to mind for the healthcare organization. I don't know, Mike, do you have any thoughts about what kind of financial considerations?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's going to vary very much based on the transaction structure and whether it's for profit or nonprofit. But I think some big buckets to think about is if you're a slightly larger organization that's involved, you may have tax exempt or really just any sort of outstanding debt, right? And so that is going to be a big driver. And I see it in my practice a lot as a big driver of transaction structure in particular. Certainly if it is a nonprofit to for-profit transaction and you're holding any tax exempt debt, you're going to need to be able to take out that debt in order for the, you know, the transaction to go forward with, which can be an extreme expense, particularly if the bonds that you might have or notes are not callable or only callable with a pretty, you know, significant prepayment penalty. So that's definitely something to keep top of mind and one of the first things to look at, at least I look at when a entity that has any significant debt is really looking at a transaction. You know, other things then just moving forward is, you know, are you getting fair value for whatever it is? And that doesn't have to be cash, right? Particularly if it's a nonprofit to nonprofit transaction. I mean, there is a lot of flexibility there. And I think Emily could speak to this as well. But, you know, that at the end of the day, in a lot of those transactions, what we do see is in lieu of cash, and I wouldn't say exclusively, this is what we see, but oftentimes you see just commitments, you know, to service down the line, right? Commitments to keep whatever the asset is, be it a facility, a provider group, that going on, you know, commitments to capital for that organization, you know, but that's all kind of post-closing commitments and not a bolus of an infusion of liquid assets, right, that are coming in. So it's something to keep in mind as a director. The other thing then, which Emily, hit on is, are there any restricted gifts, right? And not just restricted gifts, but what is going to be the use of the organization post-closing? And if it's going to be different than its current purposes, does that align with, what its charitable mission is? And if it doesn't, then that could be a problem, right? And that would be something that you'd have to go talk with the Attorney General's office and potentially get a petition, for change in use. But similarly, if there are just any restricted gifts out there, I see this a lot in actually the university context, which I know is a little outside of this scope, but there's a lot of endowed gifts out there. And if you're doing some sort of combination and some of those programs are not going to be in existence post-closing, then you potentially have a problem where you might need some sort of CyPRE or, other relief from the AG's office, which Emily, I'm trying to put this up to you as maybe you have thoughts on this question.
I do. I actually, it prompted a thought in me, which we've been seeing a lot lately, actually, with the kind of dissolution or wind down of a lot of these charitable entities, are some trusts that are not administered by the organization itself, but held by like an institutional trustee. And folks don't think about them as they're winding down their operations. And then you have these trusts that are sitting for years and, in like one big foul swoop, Bank of America will come to us and say, oh, I've got like these six trusts that used to benefit this nursing home that doesn't exist anymore. Like, help us clean them up. But to the extent that they exist, it's an important thing to start thinking about as your client is winding down its operations. And to the same end, if you have a client who is so far in debt that they really are effectuating this transfer just to continue the continuity of services, right? But there's not going to be any resulting cash in the organization. Our office is going to ask you questions about what you're doing to manage the debt on the back end. So once you're out of the service provision, how are you winding down your operations? How are you managing your debt? And how are you wrapping things up? Those are questions that we're going to want answers to as well.
And I know, a number of the reasons that healthcare organizations are looking at transactions is because of the staffing shortage, right? And they just don't have the manpower. So, Cheryl, have you seen partners offer that support on an interim basis to help bridge sort of the period of, the negotiation and the regulatory approval process to kind of get people over the finish line?
Certainly. I have seen, in particular, one recent transaction where we had an affiliation agreement, but we had some soft debt, and it wasn't huge in amount, but it was a MassDox loan, and so involved a lot of public entities who had kind of put money into the organization, and we needed to get their approval of the transaction. So it's not necessary. You may have small amount of debt or some debt that you don't even think of as debt. That might require consent, depending on how the transaction is structured. And those funders care. They don't just care about being paid back. They may care about they've put money into this organization as kind of for the benefits to the community, and they may want some reassurance that those benefits are going to continue. In this particular instance, there was a kind of small loan, but kind of committed funders who wanted more information. And in the interim, the organization needed management help. And so we agreed to kind of a short-term management in one case and a consulting agreement in the other case to kind of bridge that gap, to get a little additional support. They did provide, I think, some of the services at the consulting services at low to no cost. So it provided some additional support to the organization in that interim period while we were getting the approvals that we needed.
So I think we're, starting to near on the hour. I just want to remind everyone who's tuned in, if you have a question, please put it in the Q&A box. I think we have one more for our panelists here that we can talk about, but actually two more. I know one of the questions we had heard beforehand that had come up through one of the sections was, have we seen any affordable housing transactions going on within the healthcare space and nonprofits? And I know we talked a lot about this. I mean, there's a lot of healthcare organizations partnering with housing organizations to deal with the migrant crisis, a lot of service agreements to come in and provide services on site for social determinants of health, to bring the services and make sure they're conveniently accessed. But I don't know if we've seen a whole lot of activity yet you know, at the transaction level, beyond service agreements. I don't know, Mike or Cheryl or Emily, have you seen any of this?
I've certainly seen it in affordable housing development context, where depending on the populations expected to be served by the affordable housing, there often is a partnership with a healthcare service organization to provide supportive services kind of in-house in the facility. And part of that is, you know, I think part of that is answers concerns that the community may have, but it also, you know, helps ensure that the populations served by the affordable housing are, you know, are successful in that housing. So I've seen some of that, but it tends to be less in connection with affiliations and more in connection with kind of new housing developments.
Emily or Mike, anything to add to that? Yeah, I think, who knows, maybe it's an area we'll start to see more on as, you know, the migrant housing situation continues and healthcare is, you know, all about being community-based and access and being where people can reach it as opposed to them coming to healthcare. We'll start to see more of that on the horizon. So I think just to close it out, I think it'd be helpful to understand if you are the surviving organization at the end of the day, you know, what do you want to make sure is being protected? And maybe I didn't say that quite right. If you were the organization, you know, who's entering into the transaction, who needs a partner, you know, what are the key things you want to consider that are protected for your organization? You know, I think we had talked about a few things that the quote unquote target would want to have in place.
Right. So I think this goes back to transaction structure and our the thoughts at the beginning is there's various levels of protection. A statutory merger between two Massachusetts Chapter 180s provides very little protection to the surviving organization from the liabilities of, you know, the previous organizations, because by operation of law, they, you know, are successor in interest in full to those liabilities, right? Now, if there is some regulatory-based inquiry and it was because of conduct that occurred prior to the closing of the old organization and the management is different and the board is different, I mean, those are all factors that, you know, the regulatory agencies, government enforcement agencies will typically take into consideration in, you know, looking at potential penalties that are involved. But just from a strict liability standpoint, you know, you're buying everything, right, as part of that. And so important things to have, obviously, are to ensure, you know, one of our first questions is D&O insurance. Make sure if you are a board member that you have adequate and industry standard D&O insurance, and there are plenty of brokers out there who can tell you what that is. Ensuring when you're closing a merger that the tails are appropriate in place, and by, one thing that I have seen happen is you accidentally kind of extinguish a policy of the non-surviving organization because you merge without thinking through what the implications are on the policy of the, you know, the existing policies that may be in place, which obviously then if a liability were to arise that would have some level of insurance coverage and it no longer does, I mean, that is, you know, for someone potentially a career-ending, you know, mistake to have made. So that is the top of mind to keep in mind. And then if we're not going down a statutory merger, you know, road, there are a number of other, you know, ways to protect the organization. If it is an asset, you know, acquisition or sale, certainly you can set up an agreement that has indemnities and escrow funds in it for the payment of claims that might arise that were not disclosed. I mean, a whole nother thing is just the level of due diligence in which you engage in, right? If you're going the statutory merger route, I want to make sure my clients are looking under pretty much every rock if they can, you know, to ensure that they really are comfortable with what they're getting. Whereas if for whatever reason you have a much more time compressed transaction, you don't have the ability to diligence the target, you know, thoroughly, that's where you want to think about, can we, you know, set up a structure that leaves a lot of liability behind? You know, you don't, in an asset transaction, you don't have to acquire the liabilities, right? And different governmental agencies are going to have different things to say about whether or not you've actually acquired the liabilities, even if you say you haven't. I mean, if you are acquiring a license or a contract, you know, they're likely going after the licensed entity, not, you know, the formerly licensed entity. So there you're going to have, you know, rely on a contractual indemnity claim at that point. So just all things to keep in mind, you know, in looking at it. And I think a big part of this is, as a member of the board or an officer of the organization, you know, ensuring that you're thinking critically about that, or we're advising those individuals to think critically about it, because at the end of the day, that goes to, you know, their fiduciary obligations to the organization, primarily their duty of care to ensure that, you know, they're being good stewards of, you know, the assets, and that they're not, you know, merging with some fly-by-night organization that's going to create all sorts of issues.
So, Emily, Cheryl, any takeaways as we wind up the conversation?
I mean, I would certainly agree with Mike that, you know, there's due diligence to be done on both sides, that you want to know who your partner is, whether, you know, regardless of what role you're in. And, you know, and it's, and you also have to do some due diligence on yourself, you know, understanding, you know, what financial commitments are out there, for the kind of on the other side, for the entity that's, you know, being the target entity, for whatever role that is. You know, often they care very deeply about the quality of care, the residents and the employees. And so, you know, often there are kind of post-closing requirements that they can put into place. And sometimes, you know, especially if the board wants a continued role, they want some ability to check in on how those requirements are playing out. And, you know, sometimes they care more about the day-to-day decisions. They don't necessarily want a board seat, but they want, you know, a meeting. They want to know, you know, how the residents are doing. Is the quality of food still good? And those types of like day-to-day things that might not necessarily rise to a board decision. You know, others, you know, want to have a board seat. And that's something that can be negotiated, you know, the one or two board seats on the new entity, if it's a kind of member substitution or a merger. You know, so those entities, you know, depending on what their goals are, what they care most about, you can usually find a way to craft it, so that, you know, both sides are getting what they, what, you know, are performing their fiduciary duties and, you know, can get what they want out of the transaction.
So Emily, any, I guess just to close us out, you know, once a transaction occurs, what's the AG's role sort of in monitoring going forward and making sure that the commitments made, you know, we're honored?
So, I mean, I don't think we have any formal role in specifically monitoring, unless for some reason, like some of the bigger transactions, there may have been commitments that we negotiated in terms of reporting back to our office. That's not infrequent with some of the larger transactions that we see. But on kind of the smaller, more common long-term care, behavioral health type things, we don't have an ongoing presence. But to the extent that there is a continuing nonprofit organization, certainly that organization has their required filing obligations with us. And to the extent that we ever hear anything, there are questions to be asked there as well. I think that, you know, the last piece that I just reiterate is that the more frequently and the more information you can provide us about your process, the better we are able to get to a point where we have fewer questions. And so it's the kind of final details of the transactions are important to us, but the process piece is just as important when we're walking through why your client has made the decision it's made and how they ended up where they are.
Well, I appreciate the three of you joining me today for this conversation. And, you know, I think if you have any questions, you can contact the BBA and they'll certainly, you know, get us in touch with any of us. And I know we're always happy to talk about this subject, as, you know, it's what we do every day, day in and day out. So thank you again. And, you know, we look forward to seeing you at some upcoming programs that the BBA is hosting. I know the health law section has a number of programs coming up in April with a conference, and I'm sure the tax exempt organization section as well. So check out the BBA calendars. So thank you.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024.
Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.